The man or woman who is not ready for a spiritual religion, and is ready for the religion of Catholicism, will go to heaven in that way, and you cannot help it. By Theodore Parker, March 16, 1868. Question. Do all spirits take cognizance of their surroundings immediately on being dismissed from the body? Answer. No. Question. Why not? Answer. It is impossible to tell why not. We cannot always account readily for this phenomenon of nature that is presented to us. Though we may master it in time, yet we may not be able to do so at once. Many spirits who pass from this sphere to a more spiritual state of being, who lay off the mortal and are clothed upon with immortality, pass through the chemical change called death, perhaps under the influence of ardent spirits, perhaps under the influence of narcotics. Such are not readily awakened to consciousness of spirit. For instance, a man dies dead drunk, and while in that state he passes out of the body. What is it that is dead drunk? Is it the body? No, it is consciousness. It goes out into the spirit world dead drunk, and it remains so till by natural law the condition passes off, and he is roused to a state of consciousness, takes cognizance of his surroundings, measures himself and that by which he finds himself surrounded by his own inner consciousness. All souls are in their external specially aggregated, yet there are no two alike. One perceives very readily all the conditions that surround him and in which he seems to live, while another is very slow to perceive them. One spirit hears that the way is open to return to earth, and straightway he comes back. Another hears of it, but his ears are not attuned to the truth of the sound, he does not believe it. It cannot appeal to him as a truth, and he does not come back for years, ages, perhaps. All are differently made up in the external, yet in the internal the Bushman, the Hottentot, the Anglo-Saxon, are all the same. Now, do not fancy that you are any better than the savage of the western wilds, for you are not. In essence they are one with you. Question. Does that state of unconsciousness generally last long after death? Answer. It is generally governed by the internal power, the internal capacity of the individual to throw off inharmonious external conditions. Some can do it more readily than others. It is governed by their internal state. With some it lasts only a few hours, with some, years. Question. In your answer to the previous question, do I understand you aright that the consciousness, the soul and the spirit, are one and the same thing? Answer. No, did I say so? Oh, no. Question. Do not some kinds of disease produce the same effects to deaden consciousness? Answer. Certainly. Whatever will render individual consciousness inactive here, renders it so there. It carries the impression there, and time must be given it to outlive that condition there, as well as here. There are no miracles performed anywhere, not even with the great God himself. Everything is done by law. You may talk of breaking laws here and breaking laws there, but God's laws are unbreakable. Question. How much does learning benefit the spirit after death? Answer. True learning benefits it a great deal. It draws out the inner powers of the spirit and makes them strong, brings them in contact with external things, gives them that active strength that corresponds to the strength of the body, which you receive by action. How strong would you be if you were to take no active part in the external physical world? For instance, suppose you sit down, or go to bed and lie the 2 months, would you get up strong? No, you would be very weak. Why? Because your limbs had been deprived of their natural activity. So with regard to your mental powers, the more you use them without abuse, the better it will be for you here and hereafter. By Sir Humphrey Davy, March 17, 1868. Question. What is the meaning of the great seeming difference in the condition, growth, and progress of man? Some learn much faster than others and with very little labor, and that a pleasure, others have to toil hard with suffering and distaste, but persevere from necessity or a sense of duty. These, contrasting their condition with that of the more favored, must naturally feel neglected by nature, or the creative power. They cannot emulate the ability they witness. Success seems to be the result of certain endowments. 1. Mentally, is an antelope. In speed, another a tortoise. One acquires wealth rapidly and easily, another fails, though he uses every effort. So in all departments of life there seems a distributing and directing power. Two rivers, starting from the same point, may, by the apparent accident of a pebble in the path of one, take widely different directions, one coursing through a land flowing with milk and honey, the other through a desert. Is the advantage or disadvantage we have seen, real or apparent? Does the credit or discredit belong to the stream, that its bed should be by green pastures or through burning sands? Will there be an equalization at some time? The soul, crippled and withered by adverse conditions, be released and made to progress proportionately faster for its delay, and overtake or outstrip the comrade whose beginning was brighter than its own, to be in turn, perhaps, surpassed again, but to demonstrate to life at large, by these different phases of destiny, that there is not in the progress of spirit the inequality that appears, that soul is but as a wide-tossed ocean, every part of which is in turn elevated or depressed, but the average level is maintained the same each drop knowing the giddy elevation and the corresponding abyss, and destined to find between the two the golden mean that constitutes the real victory, peace and joy of life. Answer. In consulting the heavenly bodies, we find that they vary in magnitude, therefore in power, in condition. Every star seems to differ from every other star. In fact, there are no two forms, either in mind or matter, that are created precisely alike. A vast variety exists, and it is very fortunate for the soul that it does, for if the contrary were true, a vast monotony would be the result. Indeed, with all the beauty that meets all their senses at every turn, in mind or matter, we should find nothing to delight us, and also nothing to depress us, but mediocrity everywhere. Nothing to aspire to, nothing to dread. As we look abroad everywhere we behold this variety, and it is exhibited with no less power in the human organization than elsewhere. We find one man laboring hard to attain his desires here. He goes yonder, and still he labors hard through centuries, through cycles of years, still he labors hard. By and by a change comes. On the other hand, we behold a man whom we see accomplishes his purposes, and seems to be riding to heaven in the chariot of ease. All goes well with him. One enjoys almost uninterrupted physical health, while another suffers almost uninterrupted physical disease. So on through the great calendar of nature. We find that all this variety may be blended into one grand scale of harmony in the life of our God. It is well that these differences exist. The soul has absolute need of their existence. Some souls would hardly unfold themselves under pleasant, harmonious conditions. They need the hard friction of affliction. They need to be brought in contact with the rude scenes and storms of life, so that the soul may grow thereby, so that it may unfold itself in a different manner from all other souls. A wise power hath fashioned us, that same power governs and guides us, and that same power will bring order out of chaos, harmony out of inharmony, perfection out of imperfection, and the great law of compensation will exempt none. Question. Why are some persons subject to singular acts while sound asleep? As in the case of a young woman rising at 3 o'clock, making a fire, filling a tea kettle, and setting the table ready for breakfast, then returning to bed, leaving the doors behind open, even to the open air, and surprised at the breakfast table with the relation of her unconscious services for an early meal? Answer. There are some persons who are furnished organically with a double motive power, each perfect in itself. These persons are capable of being used by those intelligences or minds who have laid off their own external organizations, or physical bodies. While the indwelling spirit has possession of the inner motive power, the inner nervous structure, the outside and foreign spirit may have control of the external motive nervous power, and there may be no consciousness transmitted to the indwelling spirit, because these two nervous systems, or powers, are each distinct in themselves. Though in one body, they are distinctively separate. The one conveys no intelligence to the other. The foreign spirit controls the external, while the indwelling spirit controls the internal. Here, then, is a double control of one body, each perfect in itself. Those persons who are possessed with this double nervous system you call mediums, somnambulists. You give them various names, but they are simply extraordinarily sensitive persons. Their sensitiveness consists in their having this double nervous system, nothing more, nothing less. By Theodore Parker, March 19, 1868. Question. What is God essentially? Answer. Everything. Essentially you are God, I am God, the flowers, the grass, the pebbles, the stars, the moon, the sun, everything is God. Now, that may seem to be a very material idea of God, but in reality it is not. If you can show me where God is not, then you can force me to believe that God in essence and God in form is not everywhere present to our understandings. God to me speaks through the water in the dry land, through the skies, through the flowers, through the mountains and the valleys. I cannot understand God as existing outside of nature. By Abner Neeland, Thomas Paine, Robert Hare, and Theodore Parker, March 23, 1868. Question. Please explain the following paragraph, vegetation in the moon. It was for a long time the common conclusion among astronomers that the moon was without any atmosphere, and destitute of water, and that, consequently, neither animal nor vegetable life could be supported on its surface. But several eminent modern astronomers have maintained the moon has an atmosphere, though of a very limited extent. And quite recently, Mr. Schwab, a German astronomical professor, thinks he has discovered signs of vegetation on the surface of our satellite. It is well known that there are certain dark lines, or scratches, as they appear, extending across the slopes of the highest mountains in the moon. These have been variously explained, some regarding them as the beds of dried-up streams, others as the channels left by torrents of lava, others as having some other origin. Professor Schwab claimed to have discovered in these lines a greenish color, which appears at certain seasons, lasts a few months, and then disappears. He therefore regards these lines as belts of vegetation. If his observations should be decisively confirmed by those of other astronomers, it will settle the question that the moon has both air and water, and will therefore remove any presumption against the existence of animal life on its surface. English paper. Answer. Professor Schwab is correct in his astronomical conclusions with regard to the moon. It has an atmosphere. There are land and water upon its surface, and vegetation exists, although, it is believed, in a very primal form. Astronomers are very fast becoming acquainted with many points of their science, which they have hitherto overlooked, for the world grows, and so do astronomers. The great influx of light which is being shed from the spirit world in this age, at this time, cannot fail to reach, more or less, all classes of mind, and it reaches with particular force that class of mind which is in itself scientific, those minds that desire to solve the great problems of life. It is to them that this spiritual influx descends with great power, and although they do not recognize it or understand its bearing, it is with them, impressing them with the great truth that is in the atmosphere, that is in the earth, that belongs to the stars, and to them also. The geologist is quickened by the spirit to know concerning what is entombed in the earth. The astronomer is quickened to know what is to be revealed from the starry heavens, and so on through all departments of science. Each one does not fail to receive a due portion of this light which you spiritualists call your own. Answer. E. G. presents the following question. Has any human soul had a conscious existence prior to its incarnation in the flesh? Answer. I myself have no recollection of an existence prior to the one which I passed through during the earthly life, but I have conversed with very many spirits who tell me that they have a distinct remembrance of having lived and acted through human life prior to their existence on the earth. These minds are, at present, the exceptions, but how long they will remain so we cannot tell. Judging from the great progress that has been made in this direction during the last 50 years, I should myself determine that in the course of the next 200 years, these minds, with their seemingly mystic theories, will be the rule. Other minds will add their testimony. Till the majority is with them, not with us. Perhaps you and I, long ere that time, will have been awakened to a consciousness of a prior existence to the one we enjoyed on earth. Answer. E.G. I will present a statement of facts bearing on the same subject. Reverend David Brainerd, who labored among the Indians of New Jersey in 1745, in a diary of his experience which he published at that time, mentions some of the wonders or marvelous deeds wrought by, or through, certain of the Indian diviners, conjurers, or powwow, as they were called. He says they are supposed to have a power of foretelling future events, recovering the sick by making passes upon them, charming persons to death, and that their spirit, in its various operations, seems to be a fanatical imitation of the spirit of prophecy that the church in early ages was favored with. He became particularly acquainted with one of these diviners, whom he represents to have been sincere, honest, and conscientious, and some of whose sentiments, Mr. Brainerd said, seemed to him to be very just. This Indian, in describing to Brainerd the way in which he obtained this power that he had of foretelling future events, knowing the secret thoughts of men, restoring the sick to health, and see, said, that before he was born he was admitted into the presence of a great man, in a world above, and at a vast distance from this world, who informed the Indian that he loved, pitied, and desired to do him good. This great man was clothed with the brightest day he ever saw, yea, a day of many years, of everlasting continuance. This whole world was drawn upon him, so that in him the earth and all things in it might be seen. By the side of this great man stood his shade, shadow, or spirit, which filled all places, and was most agreeable and wonderful to him. This great man told him he must come down to earth, be born of such a woman, meet with such and such things, and that once in his life he should be guilty of murder. At this the Indian was displeased, and told the great man that he never would murder, but he replied, I have said it, and it shall be so. All of this afterwards happened to the Indian, that is, he afterwards came upon earth, was born of that particular woman, met with such and such incidents, as had been predicted, and had also, on one occasion, committed murder, wholly unconscious at the time that he was fulfilling a prediction made in reference to him prior to his birth. The great man asked him what he would choose in life. He replied, to be a hunter, and afterwards to be a powwow, or diviner, whereupon the great man told him he should have what he desired, and that his shade, or shadow, should go along with him down to earth, and be with him forever. There were no words at this time spoken between them. The conference was not carried on by any human language, but they had a kind of mental intelligence of each other's thoughts. After this, the Indian says, he saw the great man no more, but supposes he came down to earth to be born. The spirit, or shade, of the great man still attended him, and ever after continued to appear to him in dreams, and in other ways. There were times when this spirit came upon him in a special manner, and then, he says, he was all light, and not only himself, but it was light all around him, so that he could see through men and know the thoughts of their hearts. Who or what was this great man that the Indian conversed with in his pre-existent state, and who marked out a definite, precise, and, in some respects, unpleasant work for the Indian to perform on earth? Does he resemble the grand man of Swedenborg? Answer. I should say that this great man was none other than some guardian spirit, whose mission was to watch over this Indian, and perhaps to watch over many others. Question. Jesus, a day or two before his death, said, Father, I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do, and now glorify thou me, Father, with thyself, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was, and now I come to thee. I would inquire whether these and other words of Jesus connected therewith do not imply that he had the idea of his pre-existence? Answer. Jesus tells us that he clearly and distinctly remembered a long existence prior to the one that was crossed by so much sorrow. He tells us that he knew it when here, but that he was not permitted to speak in the fullness of wisdom, because of the ignorance of his followers. He was permitted to give them just such mental food as their condition demanded, and none other. He says he knew that he had existed through all the past as a distinct individuality, moving through different spheres, and acting under different conditions, but never once losing his own particular individuality. He tells us this in our spirit spheres, and it is upon his testimony that thousands of spirits are seeking to know if they too are not, in this sense, immortal. Immortality, to the spirit, does not simply mean the future, but it implies that the soul has come through all the past, that its immortality rests upon the past as well as upon the future. It embraces all of eternity. If the soul was not a conscious spirit in the past, then it was not a soul. It did not possess that birthright to immortality which we suppose it to possess. Although I myself have no consciousness of a prior existence, yet I have the utmost faith in the testimony of those who have. Question. Brainerd further represents the Indian as saying, that the spirit, or shadow, of the great man continued to appear to him in dreams and other ways until he felt the power of God's word upon his heart, since which time it has entirely left him. I would inquire what, in the opinion of the controlling intelligence, was the cause of the cessation of the Indian's mediumship, as I suppose his peculiar power would be called in modern phrase. Answer. It is impossible to tell what the cause was. You and I may both suppose what it may be, but we cannot know. Modern media are watched over and guarded by a certain class of spirits for a certain time. Suddenly they leave them. They never hear of them again. They cannot tell why it is that these things are so. Question. You say that all spirits, that everything, is eternal, yet I find that spiritualists, as well as all religionists, pray to a great first cause. If everything is eternal, what need of this? Answer. We use certain terms here upon earth to convey certain ideas. They are, perhaps, the best that we could use, under the circumstances, and yet they fail to convey half that we wish to convey to you. In our prayers to the great God, the Father and Mother of us all, we do but pray to that intelligence which is superior to our own, to that good which is beyond us in goodness, to that something which we feel that we must rely upon in our own individual weakness. It is like the atom praying to the mountain. It is like one drop of the great ocean praying to all the other drops. Prayer lifts us in the moral scale of being. It never fails to, for we never give birth to an honest prayer without leaving some of our darkness below us, without rising somewhat spiritually. From the very fact that we have desired to pray, we know that we are ascending, that the darkness is passing away. When we pray, we draw to ourselves a higher class of intelligences, and because they are higher they are disposed to aid us, for the better always lends of its aid to that which is below it. It is the order of life. We pray simply because we feel that there is a necessity for our praying. We cannot tell from whence the necessity comes. We cannot tell where the prayer will find its stopping place, but we pray, and the answer comes by our own moral elevation. By John Pierpont, March 30, 1868. Question. You say that spiritual forms are matter? Answer. Certainly they are. Question. Then how is it that they can pass through other matter, as, for instance, when a spirit enters a closed room. Why does not the matter, more dense, oppose them? Answer. It certainly does oppose them. Question. But does not hinder their entrance? Answer. No, because the spirit is always not only superior in point of beauty and excellence, but superior in point of power. I have a certain control over this crude matter because I am superior to it. As a disembodied spirit, I can pass through the walls of this room, because I am superior to them. They are but servants, so to speak, to me. They offer a certain amount of resistance. So do the waves of the ocean, so does fire, but they are not impervious to spirit. This was at page 168. Question. In passing through the waves of the ocean, or through fire, there is a displacement of the particles of matter. When spiritual matter passes through a denser medium, is there also a displacement of the particles? Answer. No, there is no need of it. Question. We call a spiritual form etherealized matter. Suppose you enclose an object in a glass case, could spirit pass through that? Answer. There is nothing in all the universe that is impervious to spirit. Question. Yet you say that spirit is matter. Answer. It is matter, but so etherealized that your senses cannot grasp it. You have many conditions of matter impervious to the gases by which you are surrounded, but you have nothing which is impervious to spirit. By Bishop Fenwick, April 6, 1868. Question. Is life, or human life, the result of chemical action? Answer. Yes, the whole universe seems to be a vast chemical laboratory, turning out its multitudinous forms, never ceasing to labor. And these physical bodies come within the realm of nature. They are the results of a chemical power that is at work in the universe. Certain chemical combinations keep them in their proper spheres. They are chemical machines upon which the spirit plays, that it may express itself during its sojourn in the earth life. Question. Can all spirits communicate here? Answer. If you mean to ask if spirits of all grades of intelligence can communicate here, I shall answer in the affirmative. It would be absolutely impossible for all spirits to find access here, to be able to communicate here, inasmuch as the channel is very limited, while the demand is very extensive. Question. Does spirit ever lose its individuality? Answer. No, I do not believe that it ever does. Question. Is there not a time, at death, when it does? Answer. No, certainly not. Death has no more power upon the spirit than it has power upon the sun. It has no effect upon it whatever. Death is a chemical change that takes place in the physical body, but it does not affect the spirit, only that it separates it from the physical body. The spirit goes forth precisely the same that it was while in the body. It has lost nothing, it has gained nothing. Question. Are we to suppose that media who claim to be under the direct influence of Jesus Christ and other ancient spirits are correct? Can those ancients come and influence the media of the present day? Answer. Yes, you are at liberty to suppose whatsoever you will. It is by no means an impossible thing for those ancient spirits to return, manifesting through modern media. Answer. By Joseph Löwenthal, April 9, 1868. Question. It has been stated here that there are vast regions of the Earth's surface yet undiscovered, almost limitless regions. If so, our geographers are greatly at fault. They represent the Earth's surface as pretty well explored, save a small space in the Arctic and Antarctic regions which is yet unknown. Will the intelligence localize the boundaries and extent of those regions? Answer. You have no right to determine that your scientific minds who have explored certain parts of the Earth are not right, so far as they have gone. So far as they have been able to reach, so far they are right. But, in their ignorance they determine, because the 170 is a boundary to their progress, materially, there is nothing beyond that boundary.